Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the New Africa Business Association Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Bilal Masadiq Bainum, speaking to you live from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show. I'd like to introduce my co-host, anybody hearing me?
Greetings, assalamu alaikum, Brother Bilal, and a greeting to our people.
Okay, yeah, look
can
like
you hear me, Brother Bilal?
I can now. I'm having problems with the direct connect, but we're on live, and I don't think we're having any more problems. We're just going to have to go the way that we're going. But again, welcome to the show. This is the New Africa Business Association speaking to you live from Washington, D.C. Bilal Masadiq, your host, along with my co-host again.
Abdul Aziz Shaheed, and greetings to all.
And greetings, Brother Aziz. Sorry for the delay and interruption, but we're going to get right on into the show. Sister Ali,
right.
Can you hear me?
Hello, assalamu alaikum. This is Sister Ali. How you doing? Sajda Ali. All
right. Sajda, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm sorry for the delay. I got my my technological wires crossed here on some areas, so I tried on my laptop
actually,
and I was like, you know what, I just
actually,
used the phone.
We was having a problem here in the studio. Our direct connect wasn't working for us, so I had to go back to manual. But we're operational, so that's the biggest thing. So again, welcome to the show, and we're going to speak to you tonight. We're going to always start out about the first hour of our show. Is network marketing and business identification, and tonight we're going to continue what we were talking about last week, and that's international business and the idea of doing business in Africa. And as we talked about before, we're trying to redo what we know as the black soil. And we know that black soil is where African Americans, along with our ancestors who were slaves, has made America so rich because of our labor, slave labor and the cheap labor that they continuously get from our productions. So now we're seeing the opportunities of taking those productions and become owners, because land is what it's all about. And we think we can do an expansion on the ownership of that land somewhere else other than the United States. But we're going to bring on a specialist that know much, much more about what we're talking about. Giving the callers a chance to call in, we see where our call-in are coming on pretty good. So, Brother Aziz, any quick comments you have to make, and then you can turn it right on over to Sister Ali, who will be hosting, be informing us all for most of the evening.
Yes,
Brother Aziz.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to. Yes, Brother Bilal, I'm looking forward to learning some things about international trade and opportunities there also, and hope that our listeners are also. I've recommended it to a number of people that, as myself, was interested in things like that. So, yes, thank you, Sister Sajda Ali, and we're looking forward to your presentation.
And with that said, Sister Sajda, we're going to turn it directly over to you. Brothers and sisters, we welcome our new host, Sister Sajda Ali.
Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum to everyone. Peace and blessings to all the who are listening. I appreciate you, Brother Bilal and Brother Aziz, for this opportunity. this is a phenomenal time right now in business, and particularly in the African-American community. And I say that with such excitement and passion because we have the opportunity to acknowledge and be aware of options and how we want to conduct business. We have a history in this country of being siloed into maybe one area or one location, and that has shown us to be successful, and even possibly pass that on through legacy to our children and our grandchildren and such. So you may come from a family of entrepreneurs, longstanding businessmen and women, in whichever field that is. That same understanding of business, that same drive, and that same field that you're in could be used outside of the United States. It could be provided internationally across national borders. Before I get into the details specifically of international business, I want to first address, I think that sometimes in our community, we are overwhelmed by the word international. We think it may be grander and larger than our capabilities. And you may have even heard the word international business be described as globalization. And that's a very large word, and that can be an intimidating word. And it may be something that once you hear it, you may not think you're capable of or have an interest for. So I wanted to take this from a basic definition standpoint. You know, nowadays when we want to verify everything, we go straight to the Internet because we understand that that is a common tool when we're talking about things like this. And so when we talk about international business, we want to talk about really the definition of how it's perceived. So you can go to Wikipedia, you can just Google this in. And international business refers to the commercial transactions between two or more countries, right? It also includes carrying economic transactions of goods, services, knowledge, technology, capital, or labor services, communication, transportation. It goes on and on. And these areas are already identified here in the United States of something that's happening or you may be involved in right now. This could happen internationally as well. You're providing services and goods in exchange of these just, as they say, overseas, across the water. And so getting the community, getting our community to become more comfortable with that mentality, I think it's key. And I say that to say, because as everyone knows who is in business, regardless of the field that you're in, you're going to have to learn about it, right? Learn more about it. And whether you were taught through personal trade, whether you were taught through family members who had the business for years and then they willed it to you and taught the system to you over time, you may have invested in the business and learn that new business. You may have bought a business from someone else. However you acquire the knowledge of the business that you have, that took time, that took energy, that took intention. International business requires the same. And understanding how you want to venture into international business. I like to list things down so people can have even more of an idea when they talk about business, working in business internationally. So many international-based businesses involve the movements of goods and services, right? That's also including employees, having an employee work in Dallas, and then now that employee is working in Singapore, right? Cross-border transactions and intellectual property. Well, what that really means is that patents and copyrights and trademarks are, you know, serviced from one country to another, over to another country. investment in foreign physical and financial assets, contract manufacturing, buying and selling in foreign currency, establishment of foreign warehousing and distribution, and so on and so forth from that. And I will say, once again, this is straight off the Internet. And I emphasize that because I want to make this a conversation where we see this opportunity as a tangible and realistic approach. And oftentimes, we become fearful of things where we're just not connected to it. The Internet helps us make connections because it breaks it down. However we want to search it out, it breaks it down to what we need to know. And I wanted to start off with speaking of international business in a way of this is possible. Because wherever you choose to go, once you have solidified the intent of doing that, whether it's in Africa or whether it's in Singapore, Singapore is listed as one of the top countries to do international business in, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in the UAE, you go into that idea with an understanding of your business is domestic or national. Now it's moved into an international arena. And I don't want to take up this whole time just me speaking over and over. I also want to invite others to chime in with their opinions, with their insight, because I want this to be a free-flowing conversation. When we think about business, international business, it can happen in many and varied dimensions. There could be a government-to-business dimension to it, where the government of the country invests in smaller businesses or private businesses. It could be government-to-government, business-to-business, private-owned business to private-owned business, business-to-government, and business-to-customer. These are the same dimensions that exist here. These are the same dimensions that you may already be involved in. So, again, they parallel. What you do domestically, what you do nationally can happen internationally. So take this this aspect of various dimensions and put it in a personal mindset, right? So for myself, my experience in international business is unique from how I have other colleagues who are involved in it. I started off in the nonprofit sector, and yes, we understand that nonprofit is still a business, right? It's the tax exempt status in the IRS makes it unique from a for-profit and other dynamics within the business where capital is not given and such. That makes it specifically different from those areas, but it is a business. So I started off in the nonprofit business, which I worked under an international organization called Sister Cities Developing Programs for Food Sustainability. And that lasted, that partnership or that work that I did with our organization lasted about 12 years. That's how I first got connected into Africa and the work that was done over there. Within that business, we were able to make food sustainability the goal. So consultations were done, assessments were done, evaluations were done. Labor was involved between the people on the ground in Tanzania, providing the services for the distribution of food. We involved technology in as far as scientific technology, acquisition of patents and verification from labs of the food to ensure the nutritional value. So, and then of course we had employees. Employees that we used were from the school system in Tanzania. So all of these elements that you would see in a for-profit still existed in a nonprofit, and this was done on an international basis. And it was done successfully for many years on that level. I'm thankful for that. From there, my international business moved to the through the diaspora, and I was working in the Caribbean. I came to the Caribbean to establish schools and programs for students with disabilities. That was by request of the Minister of Education at the time. While I was working for the government, my consulting company was working with the government for the government providing that service. I also established the first ever clinic. It was a private partnership that I created with another business owner, so there goes the B2B dimension, where we established the first ever clinic for students with disabilities. So there was a for-profit model that was created on ground versus, of course, you know, me working with the government providing those services. Now there was another service that was being provided in a business-to-business standpoint. And that was successful for over a year during the pandemic as well. And my company made really great gains financially from that opportunity. After that, I moved my company into more of a technological sphere, and so now we're doing IT, we're doing tech support, and we're venturing into cybersecurity further on. With that, we have outsourced labor from qualified IT specialists in Africa. We have a few employees who are based in Africa. So although the company is based in the United States, the labor service, the IT specialists that we have are based in Africa, right? And they provide some of the consulting and the services here in the United States. This is all possible. This is all possible when you have the intention of what you want to do and you look into the resources that are available. Oftentimes, when we talk about international business, we think about import and export and trading, direct trading. In our minds, whether it's based on movies, we've talked to specialists, conversations or such that have conditioned our thinking about international business. We think of, you know, the buying and selling of oil and minerals and raw materials. And construction, and although that is real and that does exist, it's not limited to those areas. So I say this to say, if you are in retail, in order for you to do business in Africa or wherever international part of the world you want to work in, even if it's in Mexico, right, because that is still international, considered international areas, it doesn't have to be in those isolated areas of mining or shipping. It could be retail, could be operative in Mexico. You could have a store there. You can put your sales, your goods on Amazon, and you have clients buying from Mexico. That's an exchange. International business is happening. Within the definition that we went over as far as communication, right, that was considered an aspect of international business and transaction and trade and such. And from my understanding, we have listeners from overseas. Am I correct about that, Brother Bilal?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Broadcast?
Yes, when it comes to listeners and also when it comes to our internet, especially our internet listeners, they're from all over the world.
Right. That right there, so Black Belt Wall Street is doing international communication and transaction right now. This is part of international business. We're making connections with listeners and audience members from overseas, across the border, on a global scale. And it can be that simple. It could be that simple. We have the technology now, as Brother Bilal said, through the internet to make these connections. So I wanted to start from there. I wanted to start from the idea of how tangible international business is, right? It's possible. I also want to approach the idea of international business having to be only and primarily in the capacity of you having a degree in the field. Yes, there are degrees in international business, and they're magnificent. They're wonderful. I would encourage anybody to advance their education in the field in order to reach another level. That was always taught to me. That was always a factor in our family coming from my great-grandmother. Education was primary. So always advance yourself and learn your trade and be excellent in what you do. But again, going back to the idea of making something tangible and connected with. Before there were degrees for business administration, before there were MBAs, this country operated successfully in many ways with people doing business. Some of them had no more than a fifth grade or high school education, right? But they understood business. Some of them started off in one completely different field and decided to get in business later, and they were successful in that. And then maybe that next generation said, hey, let's take it to another level and let me get a degree actually in the field of business. So I can advance what my great-grandfather started with this, you know, restaurant. Or I can, you know, franchise this restaurant. Let me learn how to do that. And instead of it being just local in one area, we can move it in through our community and maybe into another state, right? That's the advancement of business. But it takes a starting point. It takes a starting point. So I say all this not so those can feel, so those who are listening cannot feel like they are disqualified from venturing into this field of international business, and it will look different for everyone. I'm learning more and more about import and export. That is a new frame of business for myself. But I am skilled in educational-based international business and globalization. I know a little bit more about business and tech services than I do about import and export. Well, the area that you are skilled in and that you know has intention and has need for in those areas, in those communities, in those countries, look into how you can expand that business that you are an expert in into those communities and countries. Right now, as far as we know, and we're learning more every day, countries such as Sierra Leone, right, or other West African countries, they're going through somewhat of a infrastructural revival. They are rebuilding their infrastructure in many ways. And they're looking for industries that can help them do that. And not just in West Africa, but in other parts of Africa as well. Even those like South Africa or Senegal that are well-developed, they're still looking for those business connections. They're still looking for those business opportunities. If you have a construction company in Tennessee and your construction company focuses in on specializing on building bridges, that could be a resource, a highly wanted and required resource in Freetown, Sierra Leone. They may need bridges. What would be involved? The same type of research and study and inspection and evaluation that you would do as a business owner. If someone from Dallas, Texas contracted your services, you would go to Dallas and assess the environment and see what's needed because you know your craft. Those same steps, those same techniques are needed internationally when you go over. Learning about the culture is necessary, of course. That would be something that may be uncomfortable for some who are used to things being a certain way and are concerned about how would me learning about this new culture affect my business. It can affect it in a very positive way. or it can affect it in a way that's challenging for you. But as entrepreneurs, as business owners, we understand that when we step into something new, there is a risk, right? There is a financial risk. There's a risk for infrastructure. There's a risk for sustainability. These risks are there. But we do the work that's necessary in order to avoid the risk or deter the risk or limit the amount of risk. The same skills are utilized when it comes to stepping into an international based venture. One country that I'm looking into right now to do work in, the main language is English, right? Sierra Leone, they speak English. It's their primary English language. They have, of course, their tribal languages, but the primary language is English. That is something that is, you know, easier to step into. When I first did some work in East Africa and Tanzania, they spoke English, but the primary language is Swahili. So I learned Swahili. Now, I can tell you, Brother Aziz and Brother Bilal, don't ask me to start speaking to you in Swahili. You know, when it comes back to me when, you know, every now and again when I hear a word or such, right? And I'm like, oh, I don't know what that means. But I definitely keep my Google Translate close to me in case I have to do a quick review and such. But with learning the language, you also learn how the culture is. And so that helps you better understand next steps when it comes to business and how things operate. And say, okay, well, you know, I'm used to doing things here in Durham, North Carolina like this. But when it comes to Arusha, Tanzania, they're completely different. But the objective is to ensure success with that product or with that service. So what do I have to do to get that done? You know, the research that it takes to learn the culture and the people is necessary for that reason. And that's how we know business. So it's tangible. And it's also very exciting. It's also very exciting. There also are levels of security when it comes to international business. Why? Because you put yourself in a situation where you are not limited to only one medium of living and location and an area. You may have a year or a quarter where you have more success and the goods that you sold in India than you did in Indiana. And trends may change in Indiana and things are happening like that to where it's like, you know what, this is not going well here. But things continue to grow and advance and consumer profiles are improving in India. And so that is a benefit to your business. And you can see, okay, this works here better than it works somewhere else. Instead of having to be siloed in one place for your business. And that might be your starting off point, and that's fine. But able to market yourself outside of the comfort of the domestic area, it could be a benefit. It could be a great benefit. This also makes us citizens of the world. And one thing I think that's kept away from Black Americans is the idea that we are not citizens of the world. And we are. Our connection to the expansion of this globe did not stop when we came over here through slavery or other colonizing situations. It didn't stop there. We have access to go beyond what we were. We have access to that, and we have opportunities to that. So I hope that that's a good starting point. I hope that's a good starting point, what I said. And I would like to open it up for comments, please. Let's bring in the conversation. Let's bring in the conversation.
Our mics are open. Listeners, if you can hear us, we can have our mics open, so now we can hear you. Any comments that you may have for Sister Sasha, or any comments that you may have anyway about business, about your own business, our mics are open and we welcome your comments. Okay, well, Sasha, from what you were speaking on, my comments is more or less this. Now, when it comes to international trade, I think some of us have already done that. Not as big as we should have done it, but I think many of us have experienced international trade. I know we were doing quite a bit of trade out of China until the COVID thing hit us, and that was one of our biggest, trading opportunities. Was coming out of China, but when it comes to international trade. That is ongoing, and I suggest that any international trade that we can do, of course, get connected and do it. My interest, and from talking to some of the leaders, and I say leaders, some of the ministers, Christian ministers, the church ministers and all that have an interest in all Africa, want to do something in Africa, how mysterious doing things with Africa, the unknown of doing things in Africa, but nevertheless, the interest and I would even think desire is added to it, that they want to do something in Africa. And so my, I guess my question is this, when you start talking about, and I think you hit it on the head, where African Americans, we have the technology and we have the educational technology skills and even the financial abilities. And of course, we have the freedom and independence of moving around the globe any way we can, and we have that freedom to do so. But getting back to that African interest, can one get a foothold? How can African Americans get a foothold? When I say a foothold, how can we actually own land? How can we actually, that we're back home? We are looking to have a dual citizenship with our African brothers and sisters, as to where we can all live as Africans and African Americans, being vested and growing our communities in Africa with such dual citizenship. Any understandings or any comments you can make on that, on what I guess I'm dreaming about?
What you're dreaming about? It's not a pipe dream, brother. It's not a pipe dream. It's definitely possible. I was actually doing research the other day regarding citizenship in other countries, and it gave a list, and I don't have the list in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase what I remember, But when it comes to attaining citizenship in African countries, they have their own pathway for that. Many of them, they use a pathway, the traditional pathway of marriage, right? If you marry a citizen of that country, then you have access to citizenship, the availability to apply for citizenship. And from there, then you're able to acquire land, do certain type of businesses, banking. It really gives you the benefits of a citizen in from that country. Countries such as Ghana, Sierra Leone, they are taking the route, in addition to the traditional route of marriage, they are also now exploring the route of DNA and ancestral lineage. I know Sierra Leone specifically partners with a company called African Ancestry. I hope I have that information correct. AfricanAncestry.com, and it shows it's that particular company focuses, has a, they claim to have the largest database of African-based ethnic groupings throughout the continent. And they will present to you, you know, through the results, exactly which country and which ethnic group your ancestors are from. Sierra Leone is saying, if it shows, if your results are showing that you are indigenous, your ancestry is indigenous to our area, then we permit applications for citizenship. And through that citizenship, you know, acquisition of land is possible at that point. And Ghana, like I said, is doing the same thing. I don't know if they're specifically using that company, but they are using DNA results to show connections through that. Acquiring land may also be something that is that could be done through business. If you are able to establish a business in country, right, you may be able also to buy the land that your building or your business is registered. So there are opportunities. I will say that the discussion is open if you are able to make those connections, you know, have that discussion with the people. From my experience, the conversations are welcomed because they understand it and they invite who we are. They know our history. They know our history. And they are, my experiences have always been positive to where they are welcoming to Black Americans, African Americans, to establish themselves in country. When I was, I lived off and on in Tanzania within the 12 to 15 years that I did work there specifically. And I met several African Americans who lived there. Several. I met one woman from Chicago. And it was interesting. Because I was walking, I was at this parade once, this festival, it was a festival, and I'm just, you know, at this time, my Swahili is really good, so I'm going through the crowd, just speaking to people in Swahili, and I'm speaking to this one woman and passing me, you know, in Swahili, and I hear she had an American accent, and I said something else in English, and she said something in English, and we're like, what? You know, and it was, at the time, I was in my late 20s, and she was an older woman. And, you know, it was surprising that she was there, and we just started speaking. And she said, you know, I moved here in the 60s. I was like, wow. I was fascinated by that. I did not know at the time Africa was open at that time to African Americans, and she said, most certainly. It's always been open. It's always been open. And she owned her own home and the land that her home was on. Mm-hmm. And then she introduced me to other African Americans in the community. And they had a, they literally had a community, you know, of citizens. Now they're Tanzanian citizens, but because they had over time being there for so long, they advocated for the citizenship. But they're originally from the United States. So it's not a pipe dream. It's definitely possible. It's definitely possible. I would say that through business, it is, it will be a venture that more welcomed, because now you're saying I'm coming into your country with a resource that is needed, that is helpful, that would improve the condition of your country. I'm bringing this resource, you know, that looks more favorable for the request of getting land. I hope for that question that I answered it.
Not only that, you start giving me, I can start now using my imagination from what you're saying as for, because, you know, and the reason I say that, African Americans, you know, and you hear me talking about this all the time, how through slavery and through our work in the fields and basically farming and producing all types of crops for the survival of the country. And not only the survival for the country, but food that can also be sold throughout the world. If you are from the land and the slave laboring that we did and how we made this country so rich, I'm thinking that if we, and from what you just said, if we could buy land, again, the opportunity, because I don't see here in the United States where African Americans are going to be able to have the type of land that we need in order to build an independent nation for ourselves here. But if we could have the example that you just used, the few African Americans that are living already in Africa and has been there for quite a while, they own their own land, they have their own homes, and they are living their own independent life with their brothers and sisters over there. And I'm thinking now, Africa have the land. And Africans need to be productive on that land, and I think the and so if African Americans by large numbers could find where they could in groups or communities could find where they would have citizenship and the idea of living in Africa, because we already live in the United States. We can come back and forth anytime we want to, but right now we're talking about the ownership as to where we can reproduce the type of wealth in Africa that we have produced here in the United States through the ownership of land and being able to do the production of that land the way we have been able to do the production here in the United States, and in which is we have made, showed the example of how rich we made these slave owners here, these white supremacists here in the United States. How rich we have made them, only for them to continue to be white supremacists. They're talking about now Donald Trump running for president again. So as yeah. You can see the power
mm-hmm.
of supremacy, and it's uncontrollable. I mean, that insurrection, you had police officers that are in the grave as we speak because of a president who wished to be a dictator and our free democracy. So again, I don't see, again, where that white supremacy is going to ease up and stop being so racist. And I don't see why African Americans are going to advance as an independent community. I don't see where we can advance our communities and have the independence of more or less governing our own affairs and more or less making our own business plans. I just don't see where that could really be done in the United States. But what I do see where it is so, that black soil is in Africa, and I do see where we could produce that black soil and make that black soil in Africa just as productive as we have made the black soil here in the United States. So the ownership and what you just said is very encouraging because I think it's just a matter of negotiations, it sounds like, as to where we can, and having experts like yourself, and we're glad to have, and that's what we need, is those who are African-Americans who have already negotiated businesses with different parts of the world, but specifically we're talking about Africa, and to have experts like yourself and now one of our own directors who now where we can have communications with our leaders here in the United States, like I said, these churches and mass jets and other communities that are showing that they have this interest in growing their communities independently. I do see where that could exist in Africa. I think now it's just a matter of communications, dialogue, and of course we communications and direct dialogue with each other. So no, I think what you just said, I found it to be very encouraging because again, myself never have gone to Africa, never have negotiated any type of business with our brothers and sisters over there, but no, if there is a way as to where we can deal directly with the leadership of these countries and inviting the two nations, African Americans and our African brothers and sisters, to come together and grow together. Boy, would that mean independence for both of us, African Americans and Africans, because here in the United States, we're sick and tired. We're just fed up with the hate and racism. I mean, just passed a bill today. And that bill was a bill as to where you could have marriages between a man and a man and a woman and a woman. And they took in, this is a bill that hasn't even come up for legislative hearing, but the two parties advanced the bill. Didn't even wait for it to come to the floor. They advanced the bill, and both the Democrats and the Republicans came together and passed that bill even before it came up for it, before a hearing. So the importance of passing a bill saying that a man can marry a man and a woman can marry a woman, but at the time, the John Lewis bill is left pending. It's been pending now for months. The Equal Rights Bill and any other bills that has to do with our own civil rights is in question. The Affirmative Action Bill is in question. But you can advance a bill that hasn't even come up on the floor, where a man can marry a man and a woman can marry a woman. You can pass that bill, just like that, and both parties have no problem coming together. And like I said, not even waiting for the bill to come up for a hearing, you advanced it and passed it within a few hours. So that's the type of livelihood we can expect here in the United States. That's the example that's been shown to us. So naturally, as African Americans, we have to do something about our independence, and we have to do something
I wanted to ask a question, brother.
Please, by all means.
Sister Sasha, I wanted to know, when dealing with financial transactions in Africa, let's say I'm going to have some garments made in Tanzania, and I want to, make sure that my garments are going to get made, even though I haven't gone there. I'm just doing this over the internet, since I found that this company produced a certain type of garment that I'm looking for. And how would you go about something like that in terms of making sure that the monies that you send, or when you should send the money for your garments to start getting made, how would something like that be done for a novice business person, but they wanted to get into business?
That's a good question, and I'm glad you asked specifically about Tanzania. So what I would several things have to be looked upon. Definitely look at the exchange rate between the dollar and the, and with that exchange rate, also research the cost of living, the average cost of living, because if you're having garments made, you want to negotiate with the laborers of the price that you will pay for their services on a consistent basis. But you want to know what the range is. Right? You want to know what the average range is for cost of living in that area, because that will give you a point of reference to start negotiations with that. From there, I would also suggest that you open a bank account, if you can, in Tanzania, and research international-based banks that they have. In my experience, countries that have a level of high development, such as Tanzania, especially in the capital of Dar es Salaam, they have international-based banks, right, that operate. They operate here in the United States as well as over there, or they have a subsidiary bank, some kind of partner bank. I would say also try to establish a bank account there. I would strongly encourage, if you can, to start, two things. One, if you can start virtual meetings with the company owners, if they have access to internet and they can meet with you on a regular basis via Zoom, that will build a face-to-face relationship. I've seen in my time dealing in Africa is that they still strongly value interpersonal relationships, person-to-person. They still strongly value person-to-person relationships. So if you're not able to travel over there right away, I would say build a virtual profile and personal relationship with the owners of the company. But if you aren't able to travel, you traveling over there and seeing the conditions of the area where your clothes would be made, feeling the fabric, seeing the quality of the craftsmanship is invaluable to your brand. It's invaluable because now if it's everything acceptable for how you want it, you can put a stamp of approval because you've been there, you've touched it, you've been engaged with it, you've spoken personally with the people. And they take such pride into being able to show you person to person what they're able to create. I've had some outfits made from local designers out there as well in the past, and beautiful outfits, you know, and they take pride in that. So I would definitely encourage you to visit if you can. Establish a bank account over there. If you can't visit right away, establish a virtual profile with them and kind of talk with them personally. And then also look into the living cost, the cost of living, so you can start negotiations as far as how you want to pay your laborers. They may have a price, but it's good if you educate yourself on that, what is to be true.
Right.
And I believe this is for everybody, but I think Africans get a bad rap. But they will price their they will price it based off of U.S. standards from what they've heard.
Okay.
Right? But then when you do the research, you're like, well, my currency is this and your currency is this, but you won't need that money, right? Or that's where my negotiations are. Or, you know, the cost of living for me is like this and it's like that for you over there. So really when I offer you this amount, it equals the same. So I would say definitely educate yourself on that so you have you feel more empowered going into those negotiations.
Okay, fantastic. No, absolutely. Thank you very much. That was some great information you gave there for just some basics of getting started and getting to know the people that you're going to deal with. And I didn't know that, and I'm glad you shared it. Thankful that you shared that with me as well as those that were listening, because those were some very basic but very important. It's very important information that you gave up there, because again, building a relationship with people, I understand that's invaluable. And as you mentioned, to do a person to person, but a lot of people didn't know about establishing a relationship over the internet and doing some virtual communication with people, and that's fantastic. And thank
it's
you
a good
again
way to
for the for that.
I appreciate it. I want to, before the Thaisa gets started, I want to leave this on the table for everyone. I'm looking at there was a study done by the University of Georgia's Center for Economic Growth, and there was also another study done by a project called the Black Star Project. And they both looked at the racial wealth gap within the Black community. According to the University of Georgia, they say money circulates one time within the African-American community. I'm sure many of us heard that. But it circulated six times. That same dollar from the African-American circulated six times in the Latino community and nine times in the Asian community. When the Black Star Project did their analysis, they found that it wasn't that one time only lasted for 6 hours in the Black community. That's how long that dollar lasted in the Black community. When it circulated that one time, it just lasted for 6 hours, not even a whole day. But it lasted 20 days in the Jewish community and 30 days in the Asian community. When we look at the Asian, the Latino, and the Jewish community, if any of us have done shopping or any kind of commerce in those communities, we understand that the goods and services are coming from outside of the United States. So international business is happening in their community, and we are buying into it. right? So I say all that to say that, and it's here in America, right? We're giving them money, and it's lasting longer in their communities than it is ours, but they're engaging in international business. We can do that, too.
Sasha, and I'm going, and it's time to almost go to our turn it over to our natural disaster study. Tonight's show is not going to conclude anything, but it is going to be the beginning and the introduction of a new way for Africans and African Americans to advance, I think, in a way that we've never advanced before. So with the close, and I'm going to just ask this question, and then, of course, we will continue on next weekend. Sister Aisha, I guess your mother will be coming right on right behind me. But, you know, when it comes to owning our own hotels in Africa, how many hotels and resorts can Africa or here in America, African Americans say that we own? We own our own communities. So in these communities, how are in Africa? If we wanted to take a vacation, how many hotels can we go to Africa and four or five-star hotels and it's owned by Africans, or here in the United States it's owned by African Americans? How many homes and buildings, apartments, condominiums can we go into the African American community in this country? Or how many communities can we go in Africa where the homes and communities and the banks are owned by Africans? And I know here in the United States, I can tell you. In Africa, I can only guess. But when you say the dollar circulation is very poor in our communities here in the United States, and again, I don't live in Africa, but I can guess. I would guess that dollar circulation here in the United States and in Africa is a very poor circulation. Anytime you don't own businesses in your communities, I don't care whether it's here in the United States or whether it's in Africa, if you don't own businesses in your communities is a ghost community. But your community is no more than a ghost town. And that's why your money is not circulating, because you don't own any business as to where your own citizens can buy and sell their own goods and services. They're doing it from someone else. We all are consumers as far as we have some monies to consume. If we don't have monies to consumers, then we're all broke, and we all live in what is called ghettos. So that's why your monies, so your monies can't circulate, even though in the United States we have monies, but in our communities there is no business institutions. We don't have banks in the black communities. We don't have real estate of firms in the black communities. We don't have brokerage and insurance companies in the black communities and owned by the black communities. And I would say the same thing is true in Africa. So that's what I mean about if African Americans could take their industrialization along with their monies to Africa. And I think now we can now start thinking about, because the affordability And we can own our own resorts, our own homes, our own banks, our own insurance companies can all be owned, and business planning could be done by Africans and African-Americans. Brothers and sisters, like I said, this will be ongoing, and we have our experts who have been there and will continue to be going back. So, so much for the beginning of your show, because again, you have already the curiosity, things that I know myself, and I'm a financial planner, but I could only be curious about the subject that we're speaking on tonight, and I look forward to learning much more, because not only we have to learn, but at some point we can become very proactive in what we have learned and then knowing what we can do. So, sister, I'm going to let you close out your part, and then I'm going to let you introduce your mother, and your mother can continue your conversation from here on in. Thanks so much, and Brother Aziz, unless you have some closing on the business, we're going to let turn it over, let the sister say, and she'll be back with us again next week. Any closing remarks you want to make, you can, and then we'll go on into our natural disaster program.
Thank you. I just thank Sister Pazia for her presentation. Learned a lot. And I hope our listeners did. And we look forward to hearing from them again soon, next week.
Thank you very much. Yes, same time, same station, as they say. I'm looking forward to being on here on a regular basis and just working with everybody. You know, as they learn, I learn as well. So I definitely want to create more conversation in this space. So I'll see you all next week. And now we're going to turn it over to Madame Aisha Abdul Ali, our natural disaster expert. And she definitely always has a lot of great information and resources that we need as we go through seasons and seasons. So, Madame Ali, Abdul Ali.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much. Thank you, Sajda. Brother Bilal, Brother Aziz, it's a pleasure
once again. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to talk about issues, especially issues related to natural disaster and preparedness. One of the major concerns that we have in this country and throughout the world is the frequency of natural disasters on our population and the devastation that it causes to different populations. Tonight, there are many topics in preparedness that we said we were going to deal with and discuss, and we'll do that over a period of weeks. But tonight, I would like to talk about the homeless population as it relates to natural disaster, or natural disaster as it relates to the homeless population, and the devastation that it causes that particular population, and how we can help mitigate. Mitigate, once again, means to lessen the impact of natural disasters on this population. And it's very critical. So to get started, I always like to, when you hear me quoting statistics, trust me, this is statistics that we get from the research departments, the different research agencies that deal with primarily statistics of different events throughout the world. And we know that in 1921, the United States experienced over 43 natural disasters, which made the United States of America the most natural catastrophic prone country in the world for that year. They were number one in natural disaster catastrophes in comparison to the rest of the world. And this was followed by Indonesia as second. But the important thing of this 2021 data is how did the United States, how did these catastrophes in the United States affect the homeless population? What was the impact on this population? So in the past, I stated that natural disasters push over 26 million people into poverty each year around the world. When I say push them into poverty, they actually are physically pushed into that state called poverty. They don't go willingly. They are pushed. But however, of that 26 million that are pushed into poverty throughout the world, 14 million become homeless. 14 million of that 26 million become homeless people. So we have to look at the state of the people before a natural disaster. And usually most homeless people, their state prior to the natural disaster was the state of poverty. After the natural disaster, many of those people who, if they had not, who were in poverty, if they have did not become homeless prior to poverty, prior to a natural disaster, they certainly did so after the natural disaster. So we're looking at over 500,000 people in the United States who are homeless today, over 500,000 of that 14 million that are left homeless every year after natural disasters occurs. So if that's not clear, hopefully somebody will ask me a question to clarify even more, because oftentimes we don't look at data this way. We look at it as already scripted for us. Now, when we look at that homeless population, we as African-Americans have to look at the African-American population. And we know that the African-American population only represents 13% of the general population in the U.S. But the African-American population accounts for 39% of people experiencing homelessness. 39% of people in America who are experiencing homelessness are African Americans, although we represent only 13% of the total population. And more than 50% of homeless families have children. Now, this imbalance has not improved over time, and it's getting worse. Now, this is based on figures from To End Homelessness 2020. So some agencies are going to have the numbers a little different, but this is one organization that historically have put out very good data. So when we look at the homeless population, we constantly want to understand how a natural disaster will impact this population. When we look at poverty in America, the next step from being in poverty is homelessness. And so we have a tremendous obligation to look at this population. We know that poor communities, and we're talking about poverty again, poor communities have higher death rates due to disasters. When disasters increase poverty, we know that. Poverty leads to increased homelessness. Increased homelessness homelessness increases total devastation within the economy, within the society. It causes increased risk, not just to the people who are homeless, but also to the financial obligations within the different cities, the different towns, the different counties, and throughout America. This is the population that we have to learn to do more for. So when we look at these poor communities and we say that disaster increases poverty, poor communities often do not truly recover from a disaster. Now, they can improve from the period of the crisis. So you have a disaster. Poor communities can and poor people can improve from that immediate disaster, okay, because they'll get some aid or they'll get a period of time where there appears to be an improvement just from the disaster itself. Now, that improvement is not touching their position of being in poverty prior to the disaster. I hope you follow. If the audience does not follow me on that statement, please ask me to clarify, okay? But what has happened, the people have had to develop a new norm, and that new norm is a poorer status than before the disaster. Is that clear? So the level of poverty, it's a stair step. We know that there's a classification of poverty. However, there are degrees of poverty. And the degrees of poverty is based on where you were before you were pushed into the poverty. And can you even get back to that level? And most people cannot even get back to that level. So they have had to adapt to a new norm in their lives. That's where we see tremendous numbers of families with their children on the street, even more so today. So the homeless population represents single people. 66.7% of the homeless population in 2017, now we don't have any data since then, were single. Now what does that mean? It means that they had a family somewhere, but they were not a part of that family structure that they have someplace else. So now they are single homeless people, and that population represents 66.7%. Think about it. When you see a homeless person on the street, you see more individuals, single individuals, walking the street as homeless than you see families. So that's what that number means. Then, of course, you're going to have families who are homeless. And surprisingly, today we found out that 7% of the homeless people who are walking the street are veterans. And we also found now today that 34% of the homeless people live in places that are not suitable for human habitation. Now, we're not surprised about that. And places that are not suited for human habitation will be streets, live on the streets, or abandoned buildings. And unfortunately, we found out today that over 7% of homeless people were children and young adults, children who were not accompanied by a parent or an adult. And these are, and this is becoming a new norm, where we have these homeless communities in the alleys and the back streets that are young people, that are kids. And they try to stay undercover so they are not exposed on a daily basis, because there will be other jeopardies or at-risk events that take place in their lives. So there's a tremendous threat to the homeless population in America, all over the world. And it's going to be compounded by natural disasters. And it's already stated that the homeless population are least equipped to adapt to a situation. People can adapt to poverty quicker than they can to homelessness. They exist. They just barely exist in a state of homelessness with very little hope. And as natural disasters continue to occur, it's going to be extremely difficult for them to come out of homelessness, which will take them, in most cases, into poverty, one step up, or even to get back to a state where people can maintain their families the way most of us maintain ours. So we call it surviving the storm. The first storm is a natural disaster. And in some cases, the first storm for many people is poverty. And the second storm will be homelessness. And then how do they survive these natural disasters? And we know that if we do not start developing strategies to respond to natural disasters, we will not be able to eliminate the consequences, the negative consequences on more and more families. And we as African Americans in particular, we have to understand if as we, our income level decrease in this society, in one forum there was a comment made that most of us are just one paycheck away from being homeless or being in poverty. So we have a lot to do. We cannot stop the storms. Hopefully we'll learn how to mitigate them better overall in a larger society through, the elimination of the gases that causes most of the storms. But until then, we have got to do something. We have to take some action. And the greatest action that we can take is to come together, we as a people, not just African-American people, but all of society. And I constantly say every time I talk to a group, a tornado does not discriminate. It's going to land on your doorstep regardless of your ethnic identity, the way it's going to land on mine. And so we have to come together as a collective group of people, and we have to prepare. We have to prepare. We know that for every $1 spent on mitigation means preparedness to lessen the impact of a storm, it saves $4. Some data says it can save as much as $6. For every $1 spent, it saves. That's mitigation. That's disaster preparedness. This is where we have to go. And we have to be serious about it. How do we become serious about it? All of these nonprofit organizations out there, let's come together. Contact us. Let us start training America in disaster preparedness, how to mitigate the storms. We don't talk so much about recovery because we know that you first have to survive the storm before you can recover from the storm. Mitigation is survival. It's the first step of survival. And it can, and it has been proven that mitigation preparedness will lessen the impact of a storm. It won't stop it, but it will lessen the impact of it. And for many people, that is survival. So let's hear from the audience. If we have a good audience tonight, let's have some discussion because we need these nonprofits. Contact us, or we are in the process of trying to contact as many nonprofits, faith-based organizations, for-profits, so we can sit down and have a dialogue. We have a training program already designed. We use a lot of the information from the federal agencies, such as FEMA. They have some good suggestions. What they put out, we use what we know to be the best of it. But we must start practicing preparedness, folks, or many of us are not going to survive the storm. So any questions, any dialogue?
Our mics are open.
Yes, this is Brother Aziz. Sister Aisha, greetings. I wanted to say that one of the things that you mentioned in that, and I was wondering if you could expand on that a moment, was in the process of these disasters and things happening and people, you know, moving to the next step of poverty and then from poverty to homelessness, the fact that not only did the disaster itself have an impact on the people, but these natural disasters destroying the places of employment for people. Destroying the places of employment for people, does that have a big impact?
Yes, because in America, we pride ourselves on small business development. And we know that we are often trying to get small business development to occur, especially in the U.S., because small businesses employ more people, and it provides more resources directly to the immediate economy of the people. When we have a natural disaster, many small businesses don't recover, close down, and they don't recover. And we saw this with the pandemic. But the COVID, the 19 pandemic, many did not come back. That was a disaster. That was a pandemic.
Yes.
Natural disasters caused by weather, the climate change, it has the same impact on the small businesses especially. They have to close down. They cannot open. You can't go to work and you don't get paid. And that push many families into poverty. Every month, the number of people who receive assistance for food stamp, EBT, and those SNAP and those other assistance programs increases.
Yes.
If it continues to increase, there has to be a limit to it. Everything has a top limit. How many more people, and I think that people should receive assistance without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much that we can do as individuals. And that is to prepare ourselves. We have got to become empowered as a people. And we used to be. We didn't depend on other resources. We depend on our community, yes, but primarily ourselves. Our families became self-sufficient that way. So, yes, the economics will be affected in the larger society, and as it is decreased, that's going to have a trickling down effect on all of us. So did I answer your question?
Yes, definitely. Matter of fact, you added to my understanding of greatly on that, especially when you compared the natural disasters to the disasters we have from diseases and things like that. Glad you made that clear, too, that that was a national disaster, too, because of the toll it took on my question about the places of employment for people. People were not able to go to work because of this. And and how it affected the whole system.
And it's still affecting.
Put a lot of weight on the system.
Yes. And the natural disasters, Ian and Nicole, that we haven't even begun to feel the effects of those. We are feeling the immediate breeze of them, but the whole economic impact of them, it hasn't been calculated yet. And that's what, just a month away, a few weeks away, and a month away?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, and if in the U.S., if the U.S., like in 2021, if we have the, we are classified as the most catastrophic prone country in the world, and that was only from 43 natural disasters, it's projected that going into the future, we will have far more disasters than 43 in a year. Okay. And the question is, and we are probably one of the few countries that provide the level of assistance to its citizens. I'm not talking about countries that where you have health care that you don't have to pay for, aside from that. But I'm talking about everyday assistance, food assistance, as much housing assistance as we have available units. We do a lot of that in the U.S. That's going to peak out at some point. And families who have never been homeless, many of them are going to be pushed. It's called being pushed into homelessness. Now, there are some things that we can do. In natural disasters, response for homeless individuals. And this is what we have to do to help this population. The first thing we have to do is to ensure the physical safety of the individuals. Now, remember, they don't have a place to live. They don't have a place to go. They are on the corner just there. Okay. Then the next thing we have to try to provide for their psychological, some type of psychological first aid. So and that can take many forms, okay? Even just talking to someone. Sometimes it's psychological first aid. Now, this is as a result of a natural disaster, and this is what we normally think that Health and Human Services and first responders do. And that is true, but they can't touch everyone. We have to also make sure that, and this is a very critical one, that the homeless parents and their children are kept together. And that has been a major problem. Can you imagine in wake of a natural disaster, you are separated from your child or you are told that the adults can have to go over here and we'll take the children in over here? That's devastating. And understanding in the public school system, our children are getting this information about climate change. They are getting some information about climate change, and it is causing tremendous increased anxiety amongst our young children. So we all have a role to play in helping the homeless, and we have to become an advocate, develop these advocacy resources for the homeless, and we can do it. And this is all part of preparedness. So when we sit down with our families and work out our plan, our family plan on what we're going to do when a storm, when we're told to evacuate, or even if we are told to not evacuate but shelter in place, these are the things that we need to talk to our young children about. And doctors have said when you talk to young kids about natural disaster and what your family is doing to protect them, it decreases their anxiety because they know that the family has discussed it. The family knows what to do. It's when the family does not discuss it that causes them to have high anxiety. Because they're hearing about it. They hear about it on television, hear about it at school. So are there any other questions?
Mics are open. Brothers and sisters, if you can hear us, we can hear you. Our mics are open. We welcome your questions. Sister Asa, of course, I sit back and I try to give the audience a chance to speak, and I'm sure they have questions and they ask their questions when they're ready to. But in the meantime, I am ready to ask you. Question, and it's just not a question. It's information I've heard, I've received from you. And I'm going to go back to the mitigation part that you started out with and where you started out saying we're only 15% of the population, but when it comes to the disaster, homelessness and what have you, that occurs from the disaster, we're 37% of that. So we know and we see continuing disasters. The little small storm that just came through here a couple of weeks ago, Category 1, but it took out homes that fallen into the ocean. Literally just falling right into the ocean. And they say that wasn't a big storm. That was a small storm, but it still had surge from the ocean. Still caused the same damage as a Category 3 or a Category 4. So our disasters are going to happen, and they're going to continue to happen. And yes, there are going to be millions that are affected from those disasters. But when you tell me that we're only 15% of the population, and we're 37% of the of those that didn't receive any type of mitigation, and I remember you had guests on a few weeks ago, and those guests was giving us history about Katrina and some hurricanes that we have forgotten about, but they still live through down in Louisiana. And these folks still haven't recovered. There still hasn't been any mitigation, so I'm certain they're part of that 37% that you talked about, and that 37% is probably been ongoing. So I suspect that continuing disasters is going to, of course, occur, and I suspect that 37% is going to increase, but again, we're 15% of the population. Now, I could use the word racism, and one would, especially a white person, well, that's the old stereotype way of thinking, and that's the old stereotype way of speaking. But still, the proof is in the pudding. And so I'm saying, when it comes to African Americans, we have to look at our survival and our recovery a little differently, it looks like, than the rest of the population of this country, because of the, when you use the word mitigation, we don't see mitigation. And I remember the last hurricane, the big one, as to where African Americans were actually saying, as folks was being rescued, they didn't see anyone coming into their community to rescue them. They had to get out their own boats, their own float and whatever, and float their way out of that disaster on their own, or they could have perished. So, again, where do you see that 37% and keeping that 37% from increasing, especially with we only being 15% of the population? How is FEMA going to do a recovery for so many of those who are not a part of the 37%, and then include African Americans who are intentionally denied a recovery, and continuing recoveries that are going to occur? How do you see African Americans ever coming up with a fair shake of survival recovery as it stands, unless we do something, and this is, again, this has a lot to do with our business discussion that we was just holding about owning land somewhere where we can be an independent nation or have our own independent countries, our own independent communities. And, of course, we see Africa as a good possibility, but if we don't see someone like Africa as a possibility where we could have the land, where do you see African Americans as we are here in the United States, and something that's been going on a long time, and like I said, 15% of the population, but at this point, 37%. Of those who are dealing with the disaster of homelessness and what have you. That's my curiosity. And if you
okay. I want to give you the update on that statistic that I quoted. African American, now this is from the National Alliance to End Homelessness 2020 report, okay? So the African Americans represent 13% of the general population, 13%, not 15%, but account for 39%, not 37%, of people experiencing homelessness, okay? And more than 50% of homeless families with children, 50% of the homeless families with children are African Americans.
Wow.
And this hasn't improved over time. It has not. Now, interesting.
When you say this hasn't been improved over time, what are we saying?
This imbalance has not improved. It's not getting better. And let me tell you what, and this is in reference to the African Americans I'm talking about. And so recently, the World Bank president said that the severe climate shock has threatened to roll back decades of progress against poverty. You follow me? It, because of climate change and the shock of the disasters, it's going to roll back decades of progress that was made against poverty. And the poor people are going to pay a higher price, a heavier price than other people in the society. So more African Americans will become poor as we have more severe storms. And he went on to say that building resilience, resilience, as we stated, is the ability to bounce back after a storm, but bounce back better, right? But to bounce back. Building resilience to disasters not only makes economic sense, it's a moral imperative. I mean, we must build resilience if we plan to survive. And the poverty situation is going to get worse. And the progress that was made on the war on poverty, and, you know, we all heard that slogan, right? Climate change is rolling back that progress. So where do we as African Americans stand? In desperation. In pure desperation, if 50% of the homeless families with children are African Americans already, we are in a desperate situation as a people. And it's going to get worse. And we are sleeping this. We are sleeping it. We are not talking about it. Our nonprofits, our community-based organizations, if you all are out there listening, call the number for Black Belt Wall Street so we can get connected. Make contact. Send an email so we can get connected and so we can form our coalition. It takes numbers of groups coming together, because every organization has at least 5 or 10 members. Some have thousands. We need the voices. We need the voices to make our voices heard. And so we can collectively go forth with the federal aid to the federal agencies, because we all have the talent to develop resources and put together resources and to get out there and help the community, the total community, but especially the quote-unquote underserved population. And we know what that designation means. They're talking about us. But we can't do it single-handedly. And we know no one wants to talk about natural disaster until the storm is on your doorstep. But we as a people understand preparedness. We have just stopped preparing because we are now in a mindset we want everything instant. And we want to go get it instant. But we're going to have to adapt. And the ones who cannot adapt are going to be lost. And that adaptation requires us to take some steps that our grandparents, great-grandparents, knew that they had to take in order to survive. we're not so far removed from that adaptation and that preparedness strategy that they had in place for their survival of us. So we can do it, but we must do it as a collective body. And this Yes. Go ahead.
You know, that figure 13%, that's not accurate because they're counting Africans who immigrate in first and second, third generation who don't consider themselves as African American. And this whole deal about climate change is causing poverty is another myth that's put out there, and they try to stop using natural resources, organic fuels, which hire tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people on pension, and they want to get rid of it and start something else. Now, what groups should do, like you make mention, they should prepare for these things, have some sort of methodology where people can get the word out, and also you have preparations. And, I mean, that's the most safest way, the education of your children. Are they letting in all these illegal immigration? What type of burden is that putting on what limited things that you already say you don't have enough of, and anybody say you don't have enough of? So it's a lot of things need to be looked at and need to be complained about, and stop voting for these same old political parties. You still vote for them, sit back and see what happens. In the meantime, a storm come in and wash you away. Thank you very much.
Yes, I agree with you that we need to do something and stop complaining. And doing something is what we are talking about. Let's come together. And we have the power. We have the knowledge. Let's take care of ourselves and stop constantly asking someone else to take care of us or to do for us. We can do this. Yes, and we're going to have to come together, and we're going to have to do it. And there are going to be people. There are going to be other people. There are other groups who are coming together within their groups, and they are mobilizing themselves, and they are doing preparedness. So I can't worry so much about what the other groups are doing. I know that our people are not doing it, and we must do it. And the statistics are the statistics that the government relies on to make decisions. So I will give that same statistic back to them, and they can't deny their own data. Now, when we get to the point where we can do our own statistical research, I welcome that. I welcome that. But for now, this 13% of the general population is what I'm using. If you know of another number, that's fine if you want to use it. But when I talk and when we talk, we must talk according to the data that is put out there. Now, if we have the institutions who can put out other data, bring it forth. Let us see it. We are not stuck just in concrete here. And when we have to look at something different, bring it forth. Send it to us. But yes, we need folks to participate.
Yes, and what
to
that
make
says,
a commitment. Okay.
And what that says, Sister Aisha, why don't we just give them some of the information, because we will be back next Wednesday. And when, like I said, this is a subject that we're not going to be discontinuing this subject, I'll put it that way. So brothers and sisters, yes, by all means, contact us, join us. We'd like to have emails from you. We'd like to hear from you. And you can contact us by us an email, and our email is nabassc@gmail.com. nabassc@gmail.com, New Africa Business Association .com, Washington, D.C., New Africa Business Association .com, Washington, D.C., 202-903-1372. Our call-in numbers every Wednesday is 657-383-1372. And, of course, that would be blogtalkradio.com/NABASSC/URL as far as our internet. blogtalkradio.com/NABASSC/URL internet. So, Sister Aisha, you information you like to leave with them, I would ask you to go ahead and do it.
I appreciate the comments of the gentleman who just came on, and let us hear more from you. Work with us. Bring your group, your organization, if you have an organization. But we need to hear your voices, and we need to hear your concerns. And so nothing is written in stone here, like I said, in concrete. But we've got to come together as a group of people, and we can do this. And we got to save ourselves. So next week, we talked about the homeless. Next week, we will talk about another aspect that affects our lives as far as natural disaster, and that is risk, R-I-S-K, consequences. That could be financial risk. That could be health risk, but risk consequences or consequences of risk. And the whole idea is to say to our population how devastating natural disaster is, and this is becoming our new norm. And we're not, but we can survive it. Thank you.
Until then, brothers and sisters, next week.
People get ready, have a train of coming. You don't need no baggage, just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train. Just thank the Lord.